disrupting its structure and causing it to become as soft and weak as wet paper. Search YouTube for gallium infiltration to see how strange this is. The burning sulfur would spill into the bromine. Bromine is liquid at room temperature, a property it shares with only one other element, mercury. It's also pretty nasty stuff. The range of toxic compounds that would be produced by this blaze is, at this point, incalculably large. However, if you did this experiment from a safe distance, you might survive. The fifth row contains something interesting. Technetium-99, our first radioactive brick. Technetium is the lowest numbered element that has no stable isotopes. The dose from a 1 liter cube of the metal wouldn't be enough to be lethal in our experiment, but it's still substantial. If you spent all day wearing it as a hat, or breathed it in as dust, it could definitely kill you. Technetium aside, the fifth row would be a lot like the fourth. On to the sixth row! No matter how careful you are, the sixth row would definitely kill you. The sixth row of the periodic table contains several radioactive elements, including promethium, polonium. In 2006, an umbrella tipped with polonium-210 was used to murder former KGB officer Alexander Litvinenko. Astatine and radon. Astatine is the bad one. Radon is the cute one. We don't know what astatine looks like because, as Lowe put it, that stuff just doesn't want to exist. It's so radioactive, with a half-life measured in hours, that any large piece of it would be quickly vaporized by its own heat. Chemists suspect that it has a black surface, but no one really knows. There's no material safety data sheet for astatine. If there were, it would just be the word "no" scrawled over and over in charred blood. Our cube would briefly contain more astatine than has ever been synthesized. I say briefly because it would immediately turn into a column of superheated gas. The heat alone would give third-degree burns to anyone nearby, and the building would be demolished. The cloud of hot gas would rise rapidly into the sky, pouring out heat and radiation. The explosion would be just the right size to maximize the amount of paperwork your lab would face. If the explosion were smaller, you could potentially cover it up. If it were larger, there would be no one left in the city to submit paperwork to. Dust and debris coated in astatine, polonium, and other radioactive products would rain from the cloud, rendering the downwind neighborhood completely uninhabitable. The radiation levels would be incredibly high. Given that it takes a few hundred milliseconds to blink, you would literally get a lethal dose of radiation in the blink of an eye. You would die from what we might call extremely acute radiation poisoning. That is, you would be cooked. The seventh row would be much worse. There are a whole bunch of weird elements along the bottom of the periodic table called transuranic elements. For a long time, many of them had placeholder names like unununium, but gradually they're being assigned permanent names. There's no rush, though, because most of these elements are so unstable that they can be created only in particle accelerators and don't exist for more than a few minutes. If you had 100,000 atoms of livermorium, element 116, after a second, you'd have one left. And a few hundred milliseconds later, that one would be gone, too. Unfortunately for our project, the transuranic elements don't vanish quietly. They decay radioactively, and most of them decay into things that also decay. A cube of any of the highest numbered elements would decay within seconds, releasing a tremendous amount of energy. The result wouldn't be like a nuclear explosion. It would be a nuclear explosion. However, unlike a fission bomb, it wouldn't be a chain reaction, just a reaction. It would all happen at once. The flood of energy would instantly turn you, and the rest of the periodic table, to plasma. The blast would be similar to that of a medium-sized nuclear detonation, but the radioactive fallout would be much, much worse. A veritable salad of everything on the periodic table turning into everything else as fast as possible. A mushroom cloud would rise over the city. The top of the plume would reach up through the stratosphere, buoyed by its own heat. If you were in a populated area, the immediate casualties from the blast would be staggering, but the long-term contamination from the fallout would be even worse. The fallout wouldn't be normal, everyday radioactive fallout. You know, the stuff we all shrug off. It would be like a nuclear bomb that kept exploding. The debris would spread around the world, releasing thousands of times more radioactivity than the Chernobyl disaster. Entire regions would be devastated. The cleanup would stretch on for centuries. While collecting things is certainly fun, when it comes to chemical elements, you do not want to collect them all. Chapter 8. Everybody Jump. Question. What would happen if everyone on Earth stood as close to each other as they could and jumped, everyone landing on the ground at the same instant? Thomas Bennett and many others. Answer. This is one of the most popular questions submitted through my website. It's been examined before, including by science blogs and The Straight Dope. They cover the kinematics pretty well. However, they don't tell the whole story. Let's take a closer look. At the start of the scenario, the entire Earth's population has been magically transported together into one place. This crowd takes up an area the size of Rhode Island. But there's no reason to use the vague phrase, an area the size of Rhode Island. This is our scenario. We can be specific. They're actually in Rhode Island. At the stroke of noon, everybody jumps. As discussed elsewhere, it doesn't really affect the planet. Earth outweighs us by a factor of over 10 trillion. On average, we humans can vertically jump maybe half a meter on a good day. Even if the Earth were rigid and responded instantly, it would be pushed down by less than an atom's width. Next, everyone falls back to the ground. Technically, this delivers a lot of energy into the Earth, but it's spread out over a large enough area that it doesn't do much more than leave footprints in a lot of gardens. A slight pulse of pressure spreads through the North American continental crust and dissipates with little effect. The sound of all those feet hitting the ground creates a loud, drawn-out roar lasting many seconds. Eventually, the air grows quiet. Seconds pass. Everyone looks around. There are a lot of uncomfortable glances. Someone coughs. A cell phone comes out of a pocket. Within seconds, the rest of the world's 5 billion phones follow. All of them, even those compatible with the region's towers, are displaying some version of no signal. The cell networks have all collapsed under the unprecedented load. Outside Rhode Island, abandoned machinery begins grinding to a halt. The T.F. Green Airport in Warwick, Rhode Island, handles a few thousand passengers a day. Assuming they got things organized, including sending out scouting missions to retrieve fuel, they could run at 500% capacity for years without making a dent in the crowd. The addition of all the nearby airports doesn't change the equation much, nor does the region's light rail system. Crowds climb on board container ships in the deepwater port of Providence, but stocking sufficient food and water for a long sea voyage proves a challenge. Rhode Island's 500,000 cars are commandeered. Moments later, I-95, I-195, and I-295 become the sites of the largest traffic jam in the history of the planet. Most of the cars are engulfed by the crowds, but a lucky few get out and begin wandering the abandoned road network. Some make it past New York or Boston before running out of fuel. Since the electricity is probably not on at this point, rather than find a working gas pump, it's easier to just abandon the car and steal a new one. Who can stop you? All the cops are in Rhode Island. The edge of the crowd spreads outward into southern Massachusetts and Connecticut. Any two people who meet are unlikely to have a language in common, and almost nobody knows the area. The state becomes a chaotic patchwork of coalescing and collapsing social hierarchies. Violence is common. Everybody is hungry and thirsty. Grocery stores are emptied. Fresh water is hard to come by, and there's no efficient system for distributing it. Within weeks, Rhode Island is a graveyard of billions. The survivors spread out across the face of the world and struggle to build a new civilization atop the pristine ruins of the old. Our species staggers on, but our population has been greatly reduced. Earth's orbit is completely unaffected. It spins along exactly as it did before our species-wide jump. But at least now we know. Chapter 9. A Mole of Moles. Question. What would happen if you were to gather a mole, unit of measurement, of moles, a small furry creature, in one place? Sean Rice. Answer. Things get a bit gruesome. First, some definitions. A mole is a unit. It's not a typical unit, though. It's really just a number, like dozen or billion. If you have a mole of something, it means you have 602 sextillion, 214 quintillion, 129 quadrillion of them. Usually written 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. It's such a big number because it's used for counting numbers of molecules, which there are a lot of. One mole is close to the number of atoms in a gram of hydrogen. It is also, by chance, a decent ballpark guess for the number of grains of sand on Earth. A mole is also a type of burrowing mammal. There are a handful of types of moles, and some of them are truly horrifying. Wikipedia.org/wiki/file:condyluria.jpg. So what would a mole of moles, 602 sextillion, 214 quintillion, 129 quadrillion animals look like? First, let's start with wild approximations. This is an example of what might go through my head before I even pick up a calculator when I'm just trying to get a sense of the quantities. The kind of calculation where 10, 1, and 0.1 are all close enough that we can consider them equal. A mole, the animal, is small enough for me to pick up and throw. Citation needed. Anything I can throw weighs 1 pound. 1 pound is 1 kilogram. The number 602 sextillion, 214 quintillion, 129 quadrillion looks about twice as long as a trillion, which means it's about a trillion trillion. I happen to remember that a trillion trillion kilograms is how much a planet weighs. That's enough to tell us that we're talking about a pile of moles on the scale of a planet. It's a pretty rough estimate since it could be off by a factor of thousands in either direction. Let's get some better numbers. An eastern mole, Scalopus aquaticus, weighs about 75 grams, which means a mole of moles weighs 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd times 75 grams is approximately equal to 4.52 times 10 to the 22nd kilograms. That's a little over half the mass of our moon. Mammals are largely water. A kilogram of water takes up a liter of volume. So if the moles weigh 4.52 times 10 to the 22nd kilograms, they take up about 4.52 times 10 to the 22nd liters of volume. You might notice that we're ignoring the pockets of space between the moles. In a moment, you'll see why. The cube root of 4.52 times 10 to the 22nd liters is 3,562 kilometers, which means we're talking about a sphere with a radius of 2,210 kilometers or a cube 2,213 miles on each edge. That's a neat coincidence I've never noticed before. A cubic mile happens to be almost exactly 4/3 pi cubic kilometers. So a sphere with a radius of X kilometers has the same volume as a cube that's X miles on each side. If these moles were released onto the Earth's surface, they'd fill it up to 80 kilometers deep, just about to the former edge of space. The smothering ocean of high-pressure meat would wipe out most life on the planet, which could, to Reddit's horror, threaten the integrity of the DNS system. So doing this on Earth is definitely not an option. Instead, let's gather the moles in interplanetary space. Gravitational attraction would pull them into a sphere. Meat doesn't compress very well, so it would undergo only a little bit of gravitational contraction, and we'd end up with a mole planet slightly larger than the moon. The moles would have a surface gravity of about 1/16 of Earth's, similar to that of Pluto. The planet would start off uniformly lukewarm, probably a bit over room temperature, and the gravitational contraction would heat the deep interior by a handful of degrees. But this is where it gets weird. The mole planet would be a giant sphere of meat. It would have a lot of latent energy. There are enough calories in the mole planet to support the Earth's current population for 30 billion years. Normally, when organic matter decomposes, it releases much of that energy as heat. But throughout the majority of the planet's interior, the pressure will be over 100 megapascals, which is high enough to kill all bacteria and sterilize the mole remains, leaving no microorganisms to break down the mole tissue. Closer to the surface, where the pressure would be lower, there would be another obstacle to decomposition. The interior of a mole planet would be low in oxygen. Without oxygen, the usual decomposition couldn't happen, and the only bacteria that would be able to break down the moles would be those that don't require oxygen. While inefficient, this anaerobic decomposition can unlock quite a bit of heat. If continued unchecked, it would heat the planet to a boil. But the decomposition would be self-limiting. Few bacteria can survive at temperatures above about 60 degrees Celsius, so as the temperature went up, the bacteria would die off, and the decomposition would slow. Throughout the planet, the mole bodies would gradually break down into kerogen, a mush of organic matter that would, if the planet were hotter, eventually form oil. The outer surface of the planet would radiate heat into space and freeze. Because the moles form a literal fur coat, when frozen, they would insulate the interior of the planet and slow the loss of heat to space. However, the flow of heat in the liquid interior would be dominated by convection. Plumes of hot meat and bubbles of trapped gases like methane, along with the air from the lungs of the deceased moles, would periodically rise through the mole crust and erupt volcanically from the surface, a geyser of death blasting mole bodies free of the planet. Eventually, after centuries or millennia of turmoil, the planet would calm and cool enough that it would begin to freeze all the way through. The deep interior would be under such high pressure that as it cooled, the water would crystallize out into exotic forms of ice, such as Ice 3 and Ice 5, and eventually Ice 2 and Ice 9. No relation. All told, this is a pretty bleak picture. Fortunately, there's a better approach. I don't have any reliable numbers for global mole population, or small mammal biomass in general, but we'll take a shot in the dark and estimate that there are at least a few dozen mice, rats, voles, and other small mammals for every human. There might be a billion habitable planets in our galaxy. If we colonized them, we'd certainly bring mice and rats with us. If just 1 in 100 were populated with small mammals in numbers similar to Earth's, after a few million years, not long in evolutionary time, the total number that have ever lived would surpass Avogadro's number. If you want a mole of moles, build a spaceship. Chapter 10, Hairdryer. Question. What would happen if a hairdryer with continuous power were turned on and put in an airtight 1x1x1 meter box? Dry paratroopa. Answer. A typical hairdryer draws 1,875 watts of power. All 1,875 watts have to go somewhere. No matter what happens inside the box, if it's using 1,875 watts of power, eventually there will be 1,875 watts of heat flowing out. This is true of any device that uses power, which is a handy thing to know. For example, people worry about leaving disconnected power chargers plugged into the wall for fear that they're draining power. Are they right? Heat flow analysis provides a simple rule of thumb. If an unused charger isn't warm to the touch, it's using less than a penny of electricity a day. For a small smartphone charger, if it's not warm to the touch, it's using less than a penny a year. This is true of almost any powered device, though not necessarily those plugged into a second device. If a charger is connected to something like a smartphone or laptop, power can be flowing from the wall through the charger into the device. But back to the box. Heat will flow from the hairdryer out into the box. If we assume the dryer is indestructible, the interior of the box will keep getting hotter until the outer surface reaches about 60 degrees Celsius, 140 degrees Fahrenheit. At that temperature, the box will be losing heat to the outside as fast as the hairdryer is adding it inside, and the system will be in equilibrium. The equilibrium temperature will be a bit cooler if there's a breeze or if the box is sitting on a wet or metallic surface that conducts away heat quickly. If the box is made of metal, it will be hot enough to burn your hand if you touch it for more than 5 seconds. If it's wood, you can probably touch it for a while, but there's a danger that parts of the box in contact with the mouth of the hairdryer will catch fire. The inside of the box will be like an oven. The temperature it reaches will depend on the thickness of the box wall. The thicker and more insulating the wall, the higher the temperature. It wouldn't take a very thick box to create temperatures high enough to burn out the hairdryer. But let's assume it's an indestructible hairdryer. And if we have something as cool as an indestructible hairdryer, it seems like a shame to limit it to 1,875 watts. With 18,750 watts flowing out of the hairdryer, the surface of the box reaches over 200 degrees Celsius, 475 degrees Fahrenheit, as hot as a skillet on low medium. I wonder how high this dial goes. There's a distressing amount of space left on the dial. With 187 kilowatts flowing out of the hairdryer, the surface of the box is now 600 degrees Celsius, hot enough to glow a dim red. If it's made of aluminum, the inside is starting to melt. If it's made of lead, the outside is starting to melt. If it's on a wood floor, the house is on fire. But it doesn't matter what's happening around it. The hairdryer is indestructible. 2 megawatts pumped into a laser is enough to destroy missiles. At 1,300 degrees Celsius, the box is now about the temperature of lava. One more notch. Now, 18 megawatts are flowing into the box. The surface of the box reaches 2,400 degrees Celsius. If it were steel, it would have melted by now. If it's made of something like tungsten, it might conceivably last a little longer. Just one more, then we'll stop. This much power, 187 megawatts, is enough to make the box glow white. Not a lot of materials can survive these conditions, so we'll have to assume the box is indestructible. Unfortunately, the floor isn't. Before it can burn its way through the floor, someone throws a water balloon under it. The burst of steam launches the box out of the front door and onto the sidewalk. Note, if you're ever trapped with me in a burning building, and I suggest an idea for how we could escape the situation, it's probably best to ignore me. We're at 1.875 gigawatts. I lied about stopping. According to Back to the Future, the hairdryer is now drawing enough power to travel back in time. The box is blindingly bright, and you can't get closer than a few hundred meters due to the intense heat. It sits in the middle of a growing pool of lava. Anything within 50 to 100 meters bursts into flame. A column of heat and smoke rise high into the air. Periodic explosions of gas beneath the box launch it into the air, and it starts fires and forms a new lava pool where it lands. We keep turning the dial. At 18.7 gigawatts, the conditions around the box are similar to those on the pad during a space shuttle launch. The box begins to be tossed around by the powerful updrafts it's creating. In 1914, H.G. Wells imagined devices like this in his book, The World Set Free. He wrote of a type of bomb that, instead of exploding once, exploded continuously. A slow-burn inferno that started inextinguishable fires in the hearts of cities. The story eerily foreshadowed the development 30 years later of nuclear weapons. The box is now soaring through the air. Each time it nears the ground, it superheats the surface, and the plume of expanding air hurls it back into the sky. The outpouring of 1.875 terawatts is like a house-sized stack of TNT going off every second. A trail of firestorms, massive conflagrations that sustain themselves by creating their own wind systems, winds its way across the landscape. A new milestone. The hairdryer is now impossibly consuming more power than every other electrical device on the planet combined. The box, soaring high above the surface, is putting out energy equivalent to 3 Trinity tests every second. At this point, the pattern is obvious. This thing is going to skip around the atmosphere until it destroys the planet. Let's try something different. We turn the dial to 0 as the box is passing over northern Canada. Rapidly cooling, it plummets to Earth, landing in Great Bear Lake with a plume of steam. And then... in this case, that's 11 petawatts. A brief story. The official record for the fastest man-made object is the Helios 2 probe, which reached about 70 kilometers a second in a close swing around the sun. But it's possible the actual holder of that title is a 2-ton metal manhole cover. The cover sat atop a shaft at an underground nuclear test site operated by Los Alamos as part of Operation Plumb Bob. When the 1-kiloton nuke went off below, the facility effectively became a nuclear potato cannon, giving the cap a gigantic kick. A high-speed camera trained on the lid caught only 1 frame of it moving upward before it vanished, which means it was moving at a minimum of 66 kilometers per second. The cap was never found. Now, 66 kilometers a second is about 6 times escape velocity, but contrary to common speculation, it's unlikely the cap ever reached space. Newton's impact depth approximation suggests that it was either destroyed completely by impact with the air, or slowed and fell back to Earth. When we turn it back on, our reactivated hairdryer box, bobbing in lake water, undergoes a similar process. The heated steam below it expands outward, and as the box rises into the air, the entire surface of the lake turns to steam. The steam, heated to a plasma by the flood of radiation, accelerates the box faster and faster. Rather than slam into the atmosphere like the manhole cover, the box flies through a bubble of expanding plasma that offers little resistance. It exits the atmosphere and continues away, slowly fading from second sun to dim star. Much of the Northwest Territories is burning, but the Earth has survived. However, a few may wish we hadn't. Weird and worrying questions from the What If mailbox, number 2. Question: would dumping antimatter into the Chernobyl reactor when it was melting down stop the meltdown? AJ, in recognition of your Chernobyl response efforts, we award you with the For God's Sake, What Were You Thinking Award. It's shaped like a VHS tape of the Star Wars holiday special. Question: is it possible to cry so much you dehydrate yourself? Carl Wildermuth. Carl, is everything okay? Chapter 11, The Last Human Light. Question: if every human somehow simply disappeared from the face of the Earth, how long would it be before the last artificial light source would go out? Alan. Answer: there would be a lot of contenders for the last light title. The superb 2007 book The World Without Us by Alan Weisman explored in great detail what would happen to Earth's houses, roads, skyscrapers, farms, and animals if humans suddenly vanished. A 2008 TV series called Life After People investigated the same premise. However, neither of them answered this particular question. We'll start with the obvious. Most lights wouldn't last long because the major power grids would go down relatively fast. Fossil fuel plants, which supply the vast majority of the world's electricity, require a steady supply of fuel, and their supply chains do involve humans making decisions. Without people, there would be less demand for power, but our thermostats would still be running. As coal and oil plants started shutting down in the first few hours, other plants would need to take up the slack. This kind of situation is difficult to handle even with human guidance. The result would be a rapid series of cascade failures, leading to a blackout of all the major power grids. However, plenty of electricity comes from sources not tied to the major power grids. Let's take a look at a few of those, and when each one might turn off. Diesel generators. Many remote communities, like those on far-flung islands, get their power from diesel generators. These can continue to operate until they run out of fuel, which in most cases could be anywhere from days to months. Geothermal plants. Generating stations that don't need a human-provided fuel supply would be in better shape. Geothermal plants, which are powered by the Earth's internal heat, can run for some time without human intervention. According to the maintenance manual for the Svartsengi Island geothermal plant in Iceland, every 6 months the operators must change the gearbox oil and re-grease all electric motors and couplings. Without humans to perform these sorts of maintenance procedures, some plants might run for a few years, but they'd all succumb to corrosion eventually. Wind turbines. People relying on wind power would be in better shape than most. Turbines are designed so that they don't need constant maintenance, for the simple reason that there are a lot of them and they're a pain to climb. Some windmills can run for a long time without human intervention. The Gedser wind turbine in Denmark was installed in the late 1950s and generated power for 11 years without maintenance. Modern turbines are typically rated to run for 30,000 hours, 3 years, without servicing, and there are no doubt some that would run for decades. One of them would no doubt have at least a status LED in it somewhere. Eventually, most of the wind turbines would be stopped by the same thing that would destroy the geothermal plants. Their gearboxes would seize up. Hydroelectric dams. Generators that convert falling water into electricity will keep working for quite a while. The History Channel show Life After People spoke with an operator at the Hoover Dam, who said that if everyone walked out, the facility would continue to run on autopilot for several years. The dam would probably succumb to either clogged intakes or the same kind of mechanical failure that would hit the wind turbines and geothermal plants. Batteries. Battery-powered lights will all be off in a decade or two. Even without anything using their power, batteries gradually self-discharge. Some types last longer than others, but even batteries advertised as having long shelf lives typically hold their charge only for a decade or two. There are a few exceptions. In the Clarendon Library at Oxford University sits a battery-powered bell that has been ringing since the year 1840. The bell rings so quietly it's almost inaudible, using only a tiny amount of charge with every motion of the clapper. Nobody knows exactly what kind of batteries it uses because nobody wants to take it apart to figure it out. Sadly, there's no light hooked up to it. Nuclear reactors. Nuclear reactors are a little tricky. If they settle into low power mode, they can continue running almost indefinitely. The energy density of their fuel is just that high. Unfortunately, although there's enough fuel, the reactors wouldn't keep running for long. As soon as something went wrong, the core would go into automatic shutdown. This would happen quickly. Many things can trigger it, but the most likely culprit would be a loss of external power. It may seem strange that a power plant would require external power to run, but every part of a nuclear reactor's control system is designed so that a failure causes it to rapidly shut down or scram. When outside power is lost, either because the outside power plant shuts down or the on-site backup generators run out of fuel, the reactor would scram. When Enrico Fermi built the first nuclear reactor, he suspended the control rods from a rope tied to a balcony railing. In case something went wrong, next to the railing was stationed a distinguished physicist with an axe. This led to the probably apocryphal story that SCRAM stands for Safety Control Rod Axeman. Space probes. Out of all human artifacts, our spacecraft might be the longest lasting. Some of their orbits will last for millions of years, although their electrical power typically won't. Within centuries, our Mars rovers will be buried by dust. By then, many of our satellites will have fallen back to Earth as their orbits decayed. GPS satellites in distant orbits will last longer, but in time, even the most stable orbits will be disrupted by the Moon and Sun. Many spacecraft are powered by solar panels, and others by radioactive decay. The Mars rover Curiosity, for example, is powered by the heat from a chunk of plutonium it carries in a container on the end of a stick. Curiosity could continue receiving electrical power from the RTG for over a century. Eventually, the voltage will drop too low to keep the rover operating, but other parts will probably wear out before that happens. So Curiosity looks promising. There's one problem. No lights. Curiosity has lights. It uses them to illuminate samples and perform spectroscopy. However, these lights are turned on only when it's taking measurements. With no human instructions, it will have no reason to turn them on. Unless they have humans on board, spacecraft don't need a lot of lights. The Galileo probe, which explored Jupiter in the 1990s, had several LEDs in the mechanism of its flight data recorder, since they emitted infrared rather than visible light. Calling them light is a stretch, and in any case, Galileo was deliberately crashed into Jupiter in 2003. The purpose of the crash was to safely incinerate the probe so it wouldn't accidentally contaminate the nearby moons, such as the watery Europa, with Earth bacteria. Other satellites carry LEDs. Some GPS satellites, for example, use UV LEDs to control charge buildup in some of their equipment. And they're powered by solar panels. In theory, they can keep running as long as the sun is shining. Unfortunately, most won't even last as long as Curiosity. Eventually, they'll succumb to space debris impacts. But solar panels aren't just used in space. Solar power. Emergency call boxes, often found along the side of the road in remote locations, are frequently solar-powered. They usually have lights on them, which provide illumination every night. Like wind turbines, they're hard to surface, so they're built to last for a long time. As long as they're kept free of dust and debris, solar panels will generally last as long as the electronics connected to them. A solar panel's wires and circuits will eventually succumb to corrosion, but solar panels in a dry place with well-built electronics could easily continue providing power for a century if they're kept free of dust by occasional breezes or rain on the exposed panels. If we follow a strict definition of lighting, solar-powered lights in remote locations could conceivably be the last surviving human light source. The USSR built some lighthouses provided by radioactive decay, but none are still in operation. But there's another contender, and it's a weird one. Cherenkov radiation. Radioactivity isn't usually visible. Watch dials used to be coated in radium, which made them glow. However, this glow didn't come from the radioactivity itself. It came from the phosphorescent paint on top of the radium, which glowed when it was irradiated. Over the years, the paint has broken down. Although the watch dials are still radioactive, they no longer glow. Watch dials, however, are not our only radioactive light source. When radioactive particles travel through materials like water or glass, they can emit light through a sort of optical sonic boom. This light is called Cherenkov radiation, and it's seen in the distinctive blue glow of nuclear reactor cores. Some of our radioactive waste products, such as cesium-137, are melted and mixed with glass, then cooled into a solid block that can be wrapped in more shielding so they can be safely transported and stored. In the dark, these glass blocks glow blue. Cesium-137 has a half-life of 30 years, which means that 2 centuries later they'll still be glowing with 1% of their original radioactivity. Since the color of the light depends only on the decay energy and not the amount of radiation, it will fade in brightness over time, but keep the same blue color. And thus, we arrive at our answer. Centuries from now, deep in concrete vaults, the light from our most toxic waste will still be shining. Chapter 12. Machine Gun Jetpack. Question. Is it possible to build a jetpack using downward-firing machine guns? Rob B. Answer. I was sort of surprised to find out that the answer was yes. But to really do it right, you'll want to talk to the Russians. The principle here is pretty simple. If you fire a bullet forward, the recoil pushes you back. So if you fire downward, the recoil should push you up. The first question we have to answer is, can a gun even lift its own weight? If a machine gun weighs 10 pounds, but produces only 8 pounds of recoil when firing, it won't be able to lift itself off the ground, let alone lift itself plus a person. In the engineering world, the ratio between a craft's thrust and the weight is called, appropriately, thrust-to-weight ratio. If it's less than 1, the vehicle can't lift off. The Saturn V had a takeoff thrust-to-weight ratio of about 1.5. Despite growing up in the South, I'm not really a firearms expert. So, to help answer this question, I got in touch with an acquaintance in Texas. Judging by the amount of ammunition they had lying around their house ready to measure and weigh for me, Texas has apparently become some kind of Mad Max-esque post-apocalyptic war zone. Note, please, please, do not try this at home. As it turns out, the AK-47 has a thrust-to-weight ratio of around 2. This means if you stood it on end and somehow taped down the trigger, it would rise into the air while firing. This isn't true of all machine guns. The M60, for example, probably can't produce enough recoil to lift itself off the ground. The amount of thrust created by a rocket, or firing machine gun, depends on, 1, how much mass it's throwing out behind it, and 2, how fast it's throwing it. Thrust is the product of these two amounts. Thrust equals mass ejection rate times speed of ejection. If an AK-47 fires 10 8-gram bullets per second at 715 meters per second, its thrust is 10 bullets per second times 8 grams per bullet times 715 meters per second equals 57.2 N, approximately equaling 13 pounds of force. Since the AK-47 weighs only 10.5 pounds when loaded, it should be able to take off and accelerate upward. In practice, the actual thrust would turn out to be up to around 30% higher. The reason for this is that the gun isn't spitting out just bullets. It's also spitting out hot gas and explosive debris. The amount of extra force this adds varies by gun and cartridge. The overall efficiency also depends on whether you eject the shell casings out of the vehicle or carry them with you. I asked my Texan acquaintances if they could weigh some shell casings for my calculations. When they had trouble finding a scale, I helpfully suggested that, given the size of their arsenal, really they just needed to find someone else who owned a scale. Ideally someone with less ammo. So, what does all this mean for our jetpack? Well, the AK-47 could take off, but it doesn't have enough spare thrust to lift anything weighing much more than a squirrel. We can try using multiple guns. If you fire two guns at the ground, it creates twice the thrust. If each gun can lift 5 pounds more than its own weight, 2 can lift 10. If we added enough rifles, the weight of the passenger becomes irrelevant. It's spread over so many guns that each one barely notices. As the number of rifles increases, since the contraption is effectively many individual rifles flying in parallel, the craft's thrust-to-weight ratio approaches that of a single, unburdened rifle. But there's a problem. Ammunition. An AK-47 magazine holds 30 rounds. At 10 rounds per second, this would provide a measly 3 seconds of acceleration. We can improve this with a larger magazine, but only up to a point. Turns out there's no advantage to carrying more than about 250 rounds of ammunition. The reason for this is a fundamental and central problem in rocket science. Fuel makes you heavier. Each bullet weighs 8 grams, and the cartridge, the whole bullet, weighs over 16 grams. If we added more than about 250 rounds, the AK-47 would be too heavy to take off. This suggests our optimal craft would comprise a large number of AK-47s, a minimum of 25, but ideally at least 300, carrying 250 rounds of ammunition each. The largest versions of this craft could accelerate upward to vertical speeds approaching 100 meters per second, climbing over half a kilometer into the air. So, we've answered Rob's question. With enough machine guns, you could fly. But our AK-47 rig is clearly not a practical jetpack. Can we do better? My Texas friend suggested a series of machine guns, and I ran the numbers on each one. Some did pretty well. The MG-42, a heavier machine gun, had a marginally higher thrust-to-weight ratio than the AK-47. Then, we went bigger. GAU-8 Avenger fires up to 61-pound bullets a second. It produces almost 5 tons of recoil force, which is crazy considering that it's mounted on a type of plane, the A-10 Warthog, whose two engines produce only 4 tons of thrust each. If you put two of them in one aircraft and fired both guns forward while opening the throttle, the guns would win and you'd accelerate backward. To put it another way, if I mounted a GAU-8 on my car, put the car in neutral, and started firing backward from a standstill, I would be breaking the interstate speed limit in less than 3 seconds. As good as this gun would be as a rocket pack engine, the Russians built one that would work even better. The Gryazev Shipunov GSH-630 weighs half as much as the GAU-8 and has an even higher fire rate. Its thrust-to-weight ratio approaches 40, which means if you pointed one at the ground and fired, not only would it take off in a rapidly expanding spray of deadly metal fragments, but you would experience 40 Gs of acceleration. This is way too much. In fact, even when it was firmly mounted in an aircraft, the acceleration was a problem. The recoil still had a tendency to inflict damage on the aircraft. The rate of fire was reduced to 4,000 rounds a minute, but it didn't help much. Landing lights almost always broke after firing. Firing more than about 30 rounds in a burst was asking for trouble from overheating. Greg Gerbel, airvectors.net. But if you somehow braced the human rider, made the craft strong enough to survive the acceleration, wrapped the GSH-630 in an aerodynamic shell, and made sure it was adequately cooled, you could jump mountains. Chapter 13, Rising Steadily. Question. If you suddenly began rising steadily at 1 foot per second, how exactly would you die? Would you freeze or suffocate first? Or something else? Rebecca B. Answer. Did you bring a coat? 1 foot per second isn't that fast. It's substantially slower than a typical elevator. It would take you 5 to 7 seconds to rise out of arm's reach, depending on how tall your friends are. After 30 seconds, you'd be 30 feet, 9 meters, off the ground. If you skip ahead, you'll learn that this is your last chance for a friend to throw you a sandwich or water bottle or something. It won't help you survive, but... After a minute or two, you would be above the trees. For the most part, you'd still be about as comfortable as you were on the ground. If it's a breezy day, it would probably get chillier thanks to the steadier wind above the tree line. For this answer, I'm going to assume a typical atmosphere temperature profile. It can, of course, vary quite a bit. After 10 minutes, you would be above all but the tallest skyscrapers. And after 25 minutes, you'd pass the spire of the Empire State Building. The air at these heights is about 3% thinner than it is at the surface. Fortunately, your body handles air pressure changes like that all the time. Your ears might pop, but you wouldn't really notice anything else. Air pressure changes quickly with height. Surprisingly, when you're standing on the ground, air pressure changes measurably within just a few feet. If your phone has a barometer in it, as a lot of modern phones do, you can download an app and actually see the pressure difference between your head and your feet. 1 foot per second is pretty close to 1 kilometer per hour, so after an hour, you'll be about 1 kilometer off the ground. At this point, you definitely start to get chilly. If you have a coat, you'll still be okay, though you might also notice the wind picking up. At about 2 hours and 2 kilometers, the temperature would drop below freezing. The wind would also, most likely, be picking up. If you have any exposed skin, this is where frostbite would start to become a concern. At this point, the air pressure would fall below what you'd experience in an airliner cabin, which are typically kept pressurized at about 70% to 80% of sea level pressure, judging from the barometer in my phone. And the effects would start to become more significant. However, unless you had a warm coat, the temperature would be a bigger problem. Over the next 2 hours, the air would drop to below zero temperatures, either unit. Not Kelvin, though. Assuming for a moment that you survived the oxygen deprivation, at some point you'd succumb to hypothermia. But when? The scholarly authorities on freezing to death seem to be, unsurprisingly, Canadians. The most widely used model for human survival in cold air was developed by Peter Tikuicius and John Frim for the Defense and Civil Institute of Environmental Medicine in Ontario. According to their model, the main factor in the cause of death would be your clothes. If you were nude, you'd probably succumb to hypothermia somewhere around the 5-hour mark before your oxygen ran out. And frankly, this nude scenario raises more questions than it answers. If you were bundled up, you may be frostbitten, but you would probably survive long enough to reach the death zone. Wait, the what zone? Above 8,000 meters. Above the tops of all but the highest mountains, the oxygen content in the air is too low to support human life. Near this zone, you would experience a range of symptoms, possibly including confusion, dizziness, clumsiness, impaired vision, and nausea. As you approach the death zone, your blood oxygen content would plummet. Your veins are supposed to bring low oxygen blood back to your lungs to be refilled with oxygen, but in the death zone, there's so little oxygen in the air that your veins lose oxygen to the air instead of gaining it. The result would be a rapid loss of consciousness and death. This would happen around the 7-hour mark. The chances are very slim that you would make it to 8. And 2 million years later, your frozen body, still moving along steadily at a foot per second, would pass through the heliopause into interstellar space. Clyde Tombaugh, the astronomer who discovered Pluto, died in 1997. A portion of his remains were placed on the New Horizons spacecraft, which will fly past Pluto and then continue out of the solar system. It's true that your hypothetical foot per second trip would be cold, unpleasant, and rapidly fatal, but when the sun becomes a red giant in 4 billion years and consumes the Earth, you and Clyde would be the only ones to escape. So there's that. Weird and worrying questions from the What If mailbox number 3. Question. Given humanity's current knowledge and capabilities, is it possible to build a new star? Jeff Gordon. I need to know by Friday. Question. What sort of logistic anomalies would you encounter in trying to raise an army of apes? Kevin. Question. If people had wheels and could fly, how would we differentiate them from airplanes? Anonymous. Chapter 14. Orbital Submarine. Question. How long could a nuclear submarine last in orbit? Jason Lathbury. Answer. The submarine would be fine. But the crew would be in trouble. The submarine wouldn't burst. Submarine hulls are strong enough to withstand 50 to 80 atmospheres of external pressure from water, so they'd have no problem containing one atmosphere of internal pressure from air. The hull would likely be airtight. Although watertight seals don't necessarily hold back air, the fact that water can't find a way through the hull under 50 atmospheres of pressure suggests that air won't escape quickly. There may be a few specialized one-way valves that would let air out, but in all likelihood, the submarine would remain sealed. The big problem the crew would face would be the obvious one. Air. Nuclear submarines use electricity to extract oxygen from water. In space, there's no water. So they wouldn't be able to manufacture more air. They'd carry enough oxygen in reserve to survive for a few days at least, but eventually, they'd be in trouble. To stay warm, they could run their reactor, but they'd have to be very careful how much they ran it because the ocean is colder than space. Technically, that's not really true. Everyone knows that space is very cold. The reason spacecraft can overheat is that space isn't as thermally conductive as water, so heat builds up more quickly in spacecraft than in boats. But if you're even more pedantic, it is true. The ocean is colder than space. Interstellar space is very cold, but space near the sun and near Earth is actually incredibly hot. The reason it doesn't seem that way is that in space, the definition of temperature breaks down a little bit. Space seems cold because it's so empty. Temperature is a measure of the average kinetic energy of a collection of particles. In space, individual molecules have a high average kinetic energy, but there are so few of them that they don't affect you. When I was a kid, my dad had a machine shop in our basement, and I remember watching him use a metal grinder. Whenever metal touched the grinding wheel, sparks flew everywhere, showering his hands and clothes. I couldn't understand why they didn't hurt him. After all, the glowing sparks were several thousand degrees. I later learned that the reason the sparks didn't hurt him was that they were tiny. The heat they carried could be absorbed into the body without warming anything more than a tiny patch of skin. The hot molecules in space are like the sparks in my dad's machine shop. They might be hot or cold, but they're so small that touching them doesn't change your temperature much. This is why, even though matches and torches are about the same temperature, you see tough guys in movies extinguish matches by pinching them, but never see them do the same with torches. Instead, your heating and cooling is dominated by how much heat you produce and how quickly it pours out of you into the void. Without a warm environment around you radiating heat back to you, you lose heat by radiation much faster than normal. But without air around you to carry heat from your surface, you also don't lose much heat by convection or conduction. For most human-carrying spacecraft, the latter effect is more important. The big problem isn't staying warm. It's keeping cool. A nuclear submarine is clearly able to maintain a livable temperature inside when the outer hull is cooled to 4 degrees Celsius by the ocean. However, if the submarine's hull needed to hold this temperature while in space, it would lose heat at a rate of about 6 megawatts while in the shadow of the Earth. This is more than the 20 kilowatts supplied by the crew, and the few hundred kilowatts of apricity, this is my single favorite word in the English language, it means the warmth of sunlight in winter, when in direct sunlight, so they'd need to run the reactor just to stay warm. When they moved into the sun, the sub's surface would warm, but they'd still be losing heat faster than they'd be gaining it. To get out of orbit, a submarine would need to slow down enough that it hit the atmosphere. Without rockets, it has no way to do this. Wait, what do you mean without rockets? Okay, technically, a submarine does have rockets. Unfortunately, the rockets are pointing the wrong way to give the submarine a push. Rockets are self-propelling, which means they have very little recoil. When a gun fires a bullet, it's pushing the bullet up to speed. With a rocket, you just light it and let go. Launching missiles won't propel a submarine forward, but not launching them could. If the ballistic missiles carried by a modern nuclear submarine were taken from their tubes, turned around, and placed in the tubes backward, they could each change the submarine's speed by about 4 meters per second. A typical deorbiting maneuver requires in the neighborhood of 100 meters per second of delta V speed change, which means that the 24 Trident missiles carried by an Ohio-class submarine could be just enough to get it out of orbit. Now, because the submarine has no heat dissipating ablative tiles, and because it's not aerodynamically stable at hypersonic speeds, it would eventually tumble and break up in the air. If you tucked yourself into the right crevice in the submarine and were strapped into an acceleration couch, there's a tiny, tiny, tiny chance that you could survive the rapid deceleration. Then, you'd need to jump out of the wreckage with a parachute before it hit the ground. Oh, that's easy. There are tons of parachutes lying around on a submarine. If you ever try this, and I suggest you don't, I have one piece of advice that is absolutely critical. Remember to disable the detonators on the missiles. Chapter 15, Short Answer Section. Question: if my printer could literally print out money, would it have that big an effect on the world? Derek O'Brien. Answer: you can fit four bills.